Arrive and Thrive would like to begin by first acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land of which we recorded this podcast and extend our respect to elders, past, present, and emerging. I have a monkey mind, which means I get distracted and lose my thoughts easily. So I'd like to talk to you about Notion, a productivity software that allows you to track projects and the other cool stuff. I've been using Notion for about a year now and have loved the freedom it gives me in my business. I'm a proud Notion affiliate as it is my one-stop shop for the back end of my business and my brain when I'm not using my brain. Does that make sense? I didn't think so. See what I mean by a monkey mind? I use Notion as a database and a way to track my programs, clients, and projects. If you're looking for a digital tool for your team, personal use, or business, you can check it out on our affiliate link in the episode description. Start today and get organized for tomorrow. Hello and welcome back to another episode. First and foremost, I want to express my deepest gratitude to each and every one of you for being part of our growing Arrive and Thrive career podcast family. That was a bit of a mouthful. Your support means the world to me and I truly appreciate your valuable time and attention. If you're finding value in our content and haven't already done so, I want to invite you to hit that subscribe button and become a regular part of our community. Also, feel free to leave a little review as well if you're that way inclined. Your subscription and review is a vote of confidence in what I do, and it fuels my passion to deliver the best content possible to help you and others thrive in their career. To subscribe, simply click the subscribe button on your favorite podcast platform, and you'll be in the loop with each new release. Now let's arrive and thrive together and have a little roar. Hello everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Arrive and Thrive Career Podcast. I'm particularly excited about this episode because I think this topic relates, I suppose, to me when I was younger, not so much now, but definitely a topic that I'm really interested in and passionate about. Through my travels with working with different schools. Andrew Kinch is here from GameAware. Andrew, how you doing?
I'm good, man. How are you?
Yeah, really good, buddy. Thanks so much for joining us. Now, you're a father of two. You're also a casual gamer of 30 years and a qualified teacher in the well-being and health space. But please introduce yourself to the listeners and share, I suppose, what GameAware is.
I think you covered it. My background is it's a bit unique in that it covers a lot of different angles that I think are important to understand this issue that we do have with a lot of young people around gaming, and then the ability to communicate that, like, there are all these benefits that can be had as well. A lot of people are kind of polarized, and that's not where the answer ever lies, really. So it's good to be able to get everybody on the same page with what we do. So GameAware is essentially working with four different groups. So we work with, like, parents and the whole family and the gamer as well. We work with schools from the educational side of it in terms of healthy gaming. We work with clinicians, like professionals for professional development. And then there's this little slice of the esports space when it comes to the pathway from grassroots to professional, and my favorite role in that space is around esports performance, like mental performance.
Fantastic. Now, just to backtrack what you're saying about how quite often video games can be polarizing, can you unpack that a little bit? Because I think a common narrative I got when I was younger and I was playing, like, you know, Nintendo 64, and then I was playing, like, Xbox 360, and the games were getting better and better and I was enjoying them more and more. And my parents, I think for a large percentage of that time, were not that particularly enthused that I was spending a bit of time on those consoles. And I was playing online, doing some basic, like, you know, team matches and things like that, and having a great time with my mates too, like FIFA and pizza nights and things like that. But I don't think they could necessarily see the positive apart from the socialization piece from that. Can you kind of unpack that a little bit from your perspective?
So I think from a parent's perspective, if you didn't grow up playing video games, you're not going to understand. And that's, like, it takes one to know one is not a new concept, right? Yep. So in my journey, sort of developing GameAware over the last 8 years or so. And in my own play, in my own struggles myself in my early 20s and whatnot, I've discovered that there is a really good theory on intrinsic motivation. It's quite well known. It's called self-determination theory. And it really just, if I'm maybe paraphrasing a little bit, there's three main sort of buckets that we try to fill in our lives. And these are intrinsic motivators that come from us as opposed to things that we're chasing. And those three motivations are built around competence, which is getting good at something, seeing progression, things like that. Autonomy, which is about being in control of your own choices. And an example of that might be creativity, like you have full control, right? And so you get absorbed in or immersed in that sense. And then relatedness, which is that social connection side of things. But it's also like community and belonging and being part of something that's bigger than just you. And we find that, like, it doesn't matter if you're a child or an adult, or if it's video games or sports or art or whatever, we're all driven to fill these buckets. And if they're not feeling full, you're going to find a way to fill that bucket. And if you're not doing it in the real world, well, what's interesting about gaming and anything that's online is the accessibility, right? And so accessibility to try and fill these buckets is sort of at the core of whether it's something is like being played healthily, if it's healthy or unhealthy play. And you'll find that if someone's not able to fill those buckets in real life, then they will turn to the virtual world to do that. And that the problem is that you just can't fill the buckets to the top if you're using gaming to do it or any kind of online stuff. It's just not capable of doing the job, but it sure can fool you into thinking that.
Interesting.
You know? And yep. So then you end up being quite unfulfilled if you're just spending all your time in game, even though you are driven by these motivators. But then there's these other motivators as well, which I'm sure we'll come across later in the conversation.
Mm. When you mean a healthy amount, like, is that a specific time metric to that? Because I know, like, a common narrative for a lot of people and a narrative that I grew up with was like, do your homework, do your chores, then you get an hour of video games. That's it. So has that, like, had from a GamerWare's perspective, like, what would you classify as a healthy relationship with video games?
Wouldn't it be lovely if we could just have a set number of hours? I mean, I've got something related to hours for you. If I'm going to simplify, when does this blurry line sort of show up between healthy and unhealthy? Like, when does it get to be too much? The most important answer, and it's really, I don't even know how you would measure this objectively, but it's if you start to get dopamine burnout, right? So if you're starting to reduce that baseline level of dopamine that you need for the ability to feel pleasure and reward, desire is a good word to describe it. And the more you do something, when you smash in that circuit in your brain, you're lowering the baseline of it, which means it's harder to feel those things. You're not able to achieve what you normally would if you haven't been overusing that circuit, if that makes sense. And I guess one study by Oxford was interesting around this. It was done by Dr. Andrew Shavilsky, I believe. And essentially, they took a bunch of, I think they were under 18-year-olds. The language they used was psychosocial adjustment. Let's just call that well-being for now. And it basically said that if you took somebody and you started playing an hour a day of video games, it boosted that well-being, right? And gamers would agree with this. Like, we do it because it's fun and makes us feel good. You might connect with your mates. And then it said that after that first hour was done, between that first hour and the third hour, it doesn't really get any better, but it doesn't necessarily get any worse in that time. And then past 3 hours, I used to say that it was a law of diminishing returns, but it turns out it drops off a cliff.
Interesting.
So your benefits past a 3-hour session are kind of gone. And if you're immersed in your game and there's all these other motivators at play, it's pretty complex, the reasons why you might play, and it depends on the game, then you might be there long past where the value is. And so you can overplay, like you can play beyond the benefits, right? And the number where they said, so if it's past 3 hours a 3-hour session in that day, and you're talking about kids that are going to school and all these things, then somewhere, if you're talking 7 days, somewhere around that 20, 21 hour a week mark, is where you might be overdoing it. And I would suggest we don't get to that point, you know? So what we often try to do is, depending on the age, depending on all sorts of circumstances, a default that we might revert to is a 3-hour session, but 4 days a week with 3 days off. And in those 3 days off, you now have an opportunity not only to reduce or, I don't know, start climbing back with that dopamine baseline, maybe a little bit, or at least preventing it from going down too far. So preventing or managing the dopamine burnout is an important part of the 3 days off. And the other side of that is that you now have space to go and fill those buckets properly in the real world, right? You have space to schedule social events, to do karate and soccer or whatever. And, oh, I don't know, maybe do your schoolwork if you're in high school or primary school. So it leaves room for fulfillment. And that only adds up to about 12 hours a week. And if somebody goes and plays an extra day, okay, you know. But if it's not working, then maybe come back to the default is what we often say and just work from there. And if somebody like if a gamer was listening to this right now and they're trying to grind ranked in Valorant to be like, that's just not enough time. I won't make it through the battle pass and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, okay, but like, what's important to you here? Is it the battle pass? Is it your rank? Is it enjoying the game? Is it the sense of competence you get when you make a good play? Like, you got to really understand what makes you tick. And that's very much what we try to help them understand.
It's a really good point, because I'm just trying to put myself back into my 20, 21 year old self when I was playing games. And, you know, you get rewarded for the amount of time that you play. There's like little values that you kind of tick, or I suppose check boxes, and like different unlocks that you can achieve based on the volume of that you play and the achievements that you gain through that process. So I imagine a part of this is like trying to get that kind of sense of accomplishment, not always directly through a video game as well.
Yeah. I'd say it mixes nowadays. So if my accomplishment, did you play Quake Live when you grew up? Are you in my era?
I played a little bit of Quake. I played Quake 3, I think, on computer. That's when I was like
roughly 15. The same game.
Yeah, cool.
Pretty close. So like in a game like Quake, it's you versus your opponents. It's skill, it's mastery. They don't change the meta. They don't adjust the values on the guns. They don't have, well, I guess they had a couple of different skins, but it wasn't too crazy in that game. There's no ranks. There's just get in there, thrash with people you don't know, thrash with people you do, and then get out, you know? And
the
so
basics.
It was, sorry?
The basics.
The basics, right? And those kinds of games were built very much around competence, autonomy, and relatedness, right? And what's interesting is if I went and jumped into Quake, but I didn't have any friends who played Quake, I might be playing that game in like a CAR capacity or CR. It's a competitive game. I would say it was a CRA capacity. So competence is the priority, right? And then relatedness comes second, and then autonomy comes last. And like where, how far apart they are is something else we kind of measure, if you want to visualize those three buckets I spoke about. And so nowadays I'm still a CRA gamer. Like I've been playing The Finals, which is a new game. And there's a lot of cool mechanics and it's a first person shooter. I enjoy those games. So the gunplay and everything is good. I feel accurate. It's got all these perks to it, but I do not enjoy The Finals or any other first person shooter nearly as much without my friends now. I want to squad up with my friends and have a few laughs and socialize. So I'm still, but sorry. And then some people would do that and don't care how good they are.
Yep.
Right. But what's interesting is some games will lean into certain motivators, and it's usually a match. But like, I had, I played on a team for Counter-Strike 1.6 like 20 years ago, and we played in leagues and whatnot. And we're all pretty competitive. We actually would have a practice, just like a soccer practice, and we'd have scrims, and then we would have our matches. We played in two different leagues, and then we had Daryl. Daryl wasn't the best Counter-Strike player, right? But he was there because we were there, and we loved Daryl. Right. So he was playing a CRA game, like it was definitely designed around CRA, but he was an RCA player. You know what I mean? So,
yeah,
understanding what makes you tick and how the game is designed is super important. So that's kind of just the context. Now to answer your question as best I can, newer games have design mechanics that lead into these extrinsic motivators, though. I want to chase my daily challenges. I want to grind for the rank. I want to do all these things. My story with rank is that we made, my friends and I got to the master's rank in Apex Legends, which is incredibly hard to do, but we did it in the particular season when it was very easy. But anyway, so we got there, but we got there and there was still like 6 weeks left in the season. We didn't touch the game for like two more seasons. So it made me wonder, well, I mean, it didn't make me, I knew this in theory, but I got to live it in practice for once, which was we got to the rank and we were chasing this carrot, right? But once we got there, it's like the intrinsic value of the game wasn't there anymore. Like it wasn't enough to keep you going. So it makes you wonder, like, if I'm playing a game a lot, am I playing it because I love it or am I playing it because I'm chasing something? Mm. Right? And a lot of games these days integrate that stuff. So it's not just good or bad. It's not compulsive versus engaging. There's a spectrum, and what you play and why you play it is somewhere on that spectrum.
Yeah, interesting. A common saying that would happen in my household too was I would say, yeah, mum, just one more level. Or, you know, yeah, dad, just 15 more minutes. Or until I'll play till I die and then I'll come to dinner. Can you, like, parents are probably still hearing those types of sayings from their young people. From a parent perspective, any insights or tips or tricks to be able to kind of negotiate that process? Or because I feel like quite often a parent will say, look, I don't know how to approach them playing as much as they do, or I don't know how to approach them taking a pause and going outside, or, you know, starting their homework or things like that. And I grew up in a household where the value of, like, the narrative of do the hard things first, then you can play, was like just drilled into my brother and my sister and I. So yeah, just would curious to hear if there's any, like, insights from your perspective of what you've noticed works that the parents can kind of adapt in their own way.
It depends is going to be a common theme here.
Yeah.
But I'll give you a couple of scenarios. So if you've got, I'm experimenting with my son, for example, right? Yep. So what I've done for him is we don't use timers. A timer is a countdown. It's easily swiped away. It feels bad when it arrives. It doesn't really teach you anything. It puts you in the passive position. So we use a stopwatch. And so he's got a separate device or physical or whatever stopwatch on the side, and he has to watch it count upwards. So I give him a period of time, let's say it's 45 minutes. And depends on the game he's playing and what he's trying to accomplish in the game as well. And if he was in a multiplayer game, which he doesn't really play yet, if he was in a multiplayer game, you know, you don't want him to leave in the middle of the game because it puts everybody else in a bad position. But we put the stopwatch in play, and if he gets off before the time limit approaches, so like the 45 minutes, if he gets off before that, we reward it intensely, because what we're doing is we're building self-regulation.
Yeah, cool.
So if you've got like a sticker system or a thumbs up system or something like that, we've got an app we use for thumbs ups and thumb downs. I will just like shower him with thumbs ups for being able to self-regulate. And that helps him achieve some other goal that we're doing for the thumbs up thing, like a sticker chart. If he gets off right about on 45 minutes, but not before, it's a wash. That's all right. Good job. Well done. I don't care if it's a couple minutes afterwards. What does that really mean other than me being super firm with my authority, right? But like if you keep going and you're like, oh, just one more, then like you're not getting the point. Before you go and start doing negative consequences, I would be really focusing on how much reinforcement there is, you know, for the self-regulation. And we find that it helps build the mindset early. Now he's 8. If you got a 15-year-old who might be swearing at you or hiding in the room or whatever, you've got potentially, if the gaming is like really frequent, you might have a bit of a problem with some kind of obsession with gaming. But don't forget, they're also teenagers, and we had different contexts for the same problems for all of eternity with teenagers and parents. At that level though, like it does definitely gets more complicated. And sometimes that's why people reach out to us. But even at the primary or the secondary level, the most important thing, primary, secondary, thinking in schools, is that a parent sits down and gets coached in the game. And I don't care if you don't like it. It's not about you enjoying the game or I'm not good at it. That doesn't matter. You're here to learn what makes them tick and help them see that you care about their passion or the thing that they love. And you're creating a connection rather than driving disconnection. Right. And so, I mean, like we've had this problem before with chess, you know, people thought chess was rotting people's brains. Chess was and comic books. No, absolutely. Right. And then we understood chess later. You know, I'm not saying that chess and gaming are exactly on the same level, but surely you've got to know that they're both games, right? And games are, you know, defined by rules and context. And there are, you know, esports are essentially competitive games. And well, for a definition of esports, I suppose for professional esports, it would have to be something that creates a spectator experience. There's plenty of competitive games out there. But only a few sort of make it to be an esport. But like I can take minor games as a PE teacher and I can compare a lot of rules in minor games to a lot of video games and even make adaptations and make a video game version of a minor game. So anyway, I've completely gone on a tangent.
But, that's okay, man.
But that's the idea.
Sorry, you were just saying a minor game. Can you just, when you refer to a minor game, what do you mean?
So especially at the younger year levels, let's say I'm a high school PE teacher. So grade sevens and grade eights. I mean, classic dodgeball, right?
Yep.
So we're doing a unit right now, actually, at my school, where we'll take a version of a game and we'll change the rules and change, like there's lots of different versions of dodgeball, but we're actually in like investigating the rules. And then we take another game and we investigate the rules. I have a dodgeball battle royale experiment. And like, it doesn't work perfectly. So at the end, we have a little reflection. It's like, okay, so what rules are working and what's not? Because the final sort of section doesn't seem to work very smoothly. Can we salvage this game with rule changes? Right. And so their job later in the unit is to create their own minor game in groups and stuff, which is really fun to get to teach the class how to play it. But like video games and minor games, an easy example might be like, Capture the Flag. Well, Capture the Flag is a game mode in a first-person shooter, and you've probably played Capture the Flag on the schoolyard at some point, right? So there's a lot of crossover. And never mind the actual sport games like NBA or FIFA, where it's literally just mocking real-life sport or simulating real-life sport. So there's, yeah, I would just say that there's a lot of similarities that people don't choose to notice, but parents are certainly just focused on sort of behaviors while they're playing games. And if they don't understand it and then see negative behaviors, then they'll simplify how they approach it. If that makes sense.
Yeah. I like that analogy. Like I'm trying to cast my mind back to say my parents' generation, and I suppose a similar kind of narrative that my nana would have probably heard is like, oh no, just one more over of cricket or just one more, you know, kick of the footy. And she'd be like, come inside, like bit different parenting to these days. But I suppose it's the same kind of concept, isn't it, with video games. It's like the self-regulation piece. I love that. Instead of going, we're counting down the time, we're actually counting up the time, and you get to see a running tally of how long you're playing for and being able to self-regulate. The part that I thought was also really interesting around how you were saying, you know, with parents trying to understand the game, understand their young person's, I suppose, interest in that particular game or mission. Because quite often you seem, from an outsider's perspective of the family unit that of the young person I'm talking to, it always seems that there is like that this friction between parents and young people around the use of video games. Mm-hmm. And in my eyes, it just comes back to that notion of being curious as a parent and going, okay, cool. Like explain to me like I'm a 5-year-old what this game is. Like, what are you trying to do? What's the objective? Is that the kind of angle that you're thinking, like that you're sharing?
Yeah. So if kids are coaching their parents, the way that we do it, like if we're working with a family, we teach the parents and the kids maybe separately about intrinsic motivation, and then we get them to typify themselves, right? Or we get the gamer to typify themselves, and we work on that with them. so that the gamer, the young person, now has the language to teach their parents why they play that game, right? And so like the summary of it all, though, if we're looking at motivation, we call it the CARED model, C-A-R-E-D. So C-A-R comes from self-determination theory, mentioned that already. E is for escape and D is for design. So if someone's playing to escape the stress in their life, some sort of mental health issue, they moved from Queensland to Melbourne and all their friends are in Queensland and they're not connecting with people, whatever, right? If just escape is a variable here, if you're playing to escape, that's the least healthy reason to play. If you're doing it for a week or two, fine, whatever. If you're doing it long-term, it's now becoming a coping tool. And that's definitely not a good reason to play video games. But it's never just one thing. So like, think of it as levels, I guess. And if escapism is high, then I'm going to say you're on your way to something unhealthy. And then the design mechanics are more that extrinsic thing I was talking about, where if it's a compulsive game that leads you to grind and play more or chase, those games are essentially asking you to spend more and more time or spend more and more money on their game. And that's typically at odds with the quality gaming that'll come from something that leads you to feel that sense of competence or connection to your friends or whatever.
Yeah, cool. So as a recap, we need to A, figure out what the motivating drivers are for that video game player.
Yep.
And then B, as a parent or guardian, understand those, because it's one thing for the young person to understand it, but then it's another thing for the parent to understand.
It's got to be communicated.
Yeah, cool. And then from there, determining what I suppose a healthy relationship looks like from the perspective of the video gamer and the parent.
Yes, and that will to some degree sort itself out when you're finding ways to fill those motivations in real life.
Cool.
So to deal with any kind of obsession, or if you wanted to casually use the word addiction here, you need a competing interest. You know what I mean? And you can joke about it, but like, you know, when kids become teenagers and they've been gaming a lot, a big competing interest for some that gets them to play a lot less or nothing at all for a while is their interest, like a love interest. Like, I don't have time to play NBA with you, buddy. You know, I've got a girlfriend or something.
Literally what happened to me.
Yeah. Like it's a competing interest. That competing interest could be, I've leveled up in footy and now I got to train twice a week and now I'm all about footy culture.
Yep.
You know, again, it's accessibility. That's the thing that just makes it so easy to dive super deep into gaming. Plus the fact that you've got accessibility in the sense that you got access to all these professionals or entertainers that are playing that game on Twitch or YouTube, and you can watch and speed up your learning so that you don't have to spend 20 hours to learn what you can find out in 10 minutes from a video. And just it's immersive and it's constantly there. So the self-regulation is what's necessary to be able to step away. And that competing interest in having those buckets filled in real life is the strongest thing. It's not just discipline where you're staring at your computer screen going, I'm not going to play. That doesn't work.
Yep.
You know, your ability to resist has finite, you know, I forget what it's called, but there's a theory for that.
Yeah.
For willpower. So.
Hello, friends. When I'm not hitting record here on the podcast, I'm delivering career management and life design workshops in schools. So far, we've supported over 45,000 individuals and counting since starting in 2019. We're in 100 schools across Victoria, a few in New South Wales, and a couple in Queensland. But we still have so much more to do. Growing our community member base is a huge focus for us, as our mission is to help all young Australians develop meaningful careers and live a fulfilling life. If we can teach young people important career management and life skills early, we hope that these skills will serve them well into their life post-school. Hooray! If you're a teacher, educator, principal, or school leader looking to add a little extra career education and entertainment to the curriculum, check out our workshops at arrivethrive.com.au. You can download our program brochure, learn about our workshops, see our prices, and read what teachers and students have said about us and how we can support your community. Thanks again for tuning in. The one thing I'd love to get your take on too is a common narrative I'll hear from young people too is they'll say, oh, I love video games. I'm thinking about being a video game designer. And that's probably the only, and aside from being a professional player, that's probably the only two career paths that they see and witness, or like an influencer perspective, as you were sharing on YouTube or Twitch. Can you just give us like a little bit of a snapshot around, you know, esports as a thing, and something that you kind of shedded light to me when we first connected was the, like, you know, there's school clubs as well that esport focused as well. And I suppose some of the benefits of being involved in esports from your perspective, and then some of the other kind of jobs and things that you've seen just in your travels that young people and parents may not be aware about when it comes to, I suppose, the video game industry.
Okay. So I guess what's interesting, and as I might've mentioned before, I'm very passionate about the grassroots esports space, because currently, to be a professional gamer, most people think must play more, right? I have to grind. I grind is my badge of honor. And at the highest level, I've had the opportunity now to do performance coaching for two teams that have basically dominated Australia, let's say, and gone internationally to play. And one of the teams has had some good success as well. And the kinds of stuff that I work on with them is not tactics. It's not micro skills or macro skills in the game. It's the mental. And that is directly linked to well-being, right? So what I've found, a lot of the time it comes up, and it's one of the things we try to structure around very early on, is if they are burnt out, which a lot of them are, they're leaving so much performance on the table. So we're doubling up from a well-being perspective. We don't want them to have this destroyed dopamine baseline from overdoing things. But we also want them to perform well. If you're playing an esport, you're playing it for performance, right? Not just casually anymore. So from that perspective, I've learned a lot of things about like the esports industry, but the connection from grassroots to esports, what I need to see in the grassroots space is this emphasis on the performance and well-being. Well, emphasis on performance to also teach well-being, right? So making sure you're sleeping well and hydrated and all those things. Things that just any general teenager who didn't play video games, if they weren't taught, might not be doing and not living a healthy lifestyle anyway, right? Now you've got like a pathway to teach these things directly linked to something they're passionate about, and you can turn it into a strength now. And so what's interesting about schools is that now we've got in Australia, and the US is a few years ahead of us in this case, I'd say, but in Australia, we now have a Scholastic Esports sort of ecosystem developing. And there's a few different leagues developing, slightly different experiences for schools. Some are face-to-face, some are online. And the schools themselves are developing curriculum around it. And some of that curriculum leads into careers, and some of that curriculum leads into like STEM outcomes, or just teaching soft skills like teamwork and communication and things that we have relied upon traditional sport to teach us for a very long time. Cause you don't explicitly teach that very well.
Yeah. Good point. Right?
And so social gaming clubs are something that I support quite a bit, and have resources for free for schools to like, here's how you get started. Social gaming clubs do a few different things for a school. The first thing is that you are now having a safe space for your neurodivergent or your anxious or any kids who are using games to escape to come in and actually have something where it actually fills buckets, like an experience together. But it's not just them. Right? There's just every kid who likes video games can come and socialize and do those things. And then you're also catering for the really competitive kids who want to extend themselves in a competitive environment where they're not just playing video games and ranked at home. Now it's a structured fixture. They might play weekly with their friends. They might even be streamed on Twitch in that league. And there's you're playing for your school. You're wearing your school colors, you know? And so a social gaming club is where that starts. And then the competitive environment is an opportunity to teach. Sorry, with the gaming club, it's an opportunity to teach these healthy gaming values as part of the club. It's an opportunity to teach performance, you know, coaching and philosophy and psychology. And all the soft skills we were mentioning, right? The teamwork and communication and leadership skills and things, which often innately just just happen. I've seen it in some teams before, and people making new friends and things like that, not just playing with their old friends. So when you start pairing something like a social gaming club, which focuses on the social and competitive side, with curriculum, which some schools, as I said, are embedding, now you're taking something where you've got all these different benefits coming, including career pathways. So what's interesting about esports is that most people focus on, as we said, the entertainer professional, which is the streamer, and content creators in general, and then the actual players who are playing on stage. And most people are like, oh, how good would it be to just play video games and not have to work a real job? And I'm like, oh, no. I work with these players. It's very hard. And if you haven't played high-level sport or high-level esports or high-level chess or whatever it is, you don't understand till you get there. There's a very, very big difference between playing, like being a player and a good player, versus being a competitor. Mm. Right. And that's what I love about that, though, is that that is an opportunity for massive personal growth, which is the way that I found myself growing in my 30s, actually, in beach volleyball, was through performance philosophy. Man, the amount of books I read so that I could be a better beach volleyball player is staggering. And philosophy, exploration of philosophy, is weird. It went into all these different areas. So from the player perspective, there's coaches, there's players, and there's managers, right? So from the actual team perspective, there are educational institutions. For example, QUT Esports. Like there's a whole program at QUT at the moment where there's a university degree. Some of the players that I've worked with, even one of the mentors on my team, came from QUT Esports. Then you've got the actual franchises, teams, and clubs. There's a whole business around running an esports organization, an org. Then there's what you mentioned before. You've got the actual video game development. And that is there's so much in that industry as well. I'll give you an example. My cousin in Canada was, I think, the art director for Ubisoft, who makes Rainbow Six Siege and other games like that. And I don't even know if he ever played video games before. He's just an amazing artist. Right. So you don't have to be a gamer to work at a games company. It's media, right? And then we've got the actual tournaments and leagues. And there's like being a tournament organizer and running the actual competition is really, really important. There's the relationships with partners and sponsors and investors. This is all just high level business stuff. And then what's really interesting as well is this broadcast side of things. So your sportscasters who might be there on the mic at the Olympics or in a soccer game or whatever, this is huge on Twitch for esports. And honestly, they make the experience for a fan, and going back through replays and stuff. And I don't know, there's another level to excitement sometimes with these casters, which is actually really fun to watch. And I'm having a great time watching my teams compete on stage, whether it's a physical stage or an online stage, and having the casters talk about this narrative and everything. And here I am going, if you only knew. but yeah, so there's a lot of different sort of pathways in the esports industry or just in the video game industry that have a lot less to do with playing the game than you'd think.
Love that. I'm going to say probably about 8 years ago, I watched this small, quick kind of Vice News documentary on esports.
I know the one.
Yeah. In South Korea.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, wow, this is like huge. And it just blew my mind that there was like stadiums packed out watching people play video games. And like these video game players were like rock stars. And I'd love to hear from your perspective where Australia is, if you're able to, like in terms of where we are on the world stage or what you see the future of like grassroots and esports happening in Australia as well.
All right. Well, it's interesting you mentioned that. So because I'm interested in grassroots to professional, and I'm involved all along the way right now to some degree, the thing that's interesting about OCE, Oceania, is that the numbers are actually obviously much smaller than North America and Europe and the Asian sort of regions. And so right off the bat, just with numbers, it's difficult to compete against these regions because it's a smaller talent pool. But that's not the only issue. We're so far away that the ping difference. So most people listening probably know what we're talking about. The latency, the signal that travels from Australia to a server in Singapore or something is much slower than one locally. And that really affects the gameplay, which it's like, imagine you're playing an actual game of soccer and you're running down the field and you're lining up to take a shot and you swing and you completely miss with your foot because the ball is actually behind you, but you didn't see it go behind you.
Yeah, I understand.
If that's a way of trying to explain. So you can't do that at the highly technical, advanced, complex level of esports. You can't do that and have a good experience. So it's difficult, even though you're online, you have this opportunity to train against everybody in the world. It doesn't really work that way. Not yet. I don't know if the technology will get there. I hope it does. And so Oceania has what we can call a region gap where it's very difficult. And so for example, my Rainbow Six Siege team to win locally, they are the best team. That makes sense, right? It's like winning at the national level. But then to go overseas and start getting a couple of wins was like, it's always unexpected. We always expect an Oceanic team to get gapped, as they would call it. And then recently they finished top 8 at Worlds.
Wow.
Which is massive, right? They just missed out on playing in front of a stage of what looked like, I don't know, 40,000 Brazilians screaming at the top of their lungs.
Wow. Right?
So it was super exciting stuff. And from my perspective, you know, I'm interested in the mental side so that we can create good competitors so that this is the thing we can control. And when it comes to this region gap, we can control our mental, we can control how we compete and not having just players that want to be good at the game, big egos and stuff like that, because there's a lot of that going on. And so that can close the gap between games. And it has for this Rainbow Six Siege team, their work ethic is unparalleled and they know how to manage their emotions, whether they've just had a massive win or a massive loss in a round, and they just know how to get on with business. Job's not done.
Mm.
So this is something that I think is really important for esports, because you can't make a brave, big physical effort, put your body on the line, put your face in front of the ball to save a goal or something.
Yep.
You know what I mean? But you can, in esports, you can't do that. So you just need to be rock solid and in a lot of different aspects. Don't know if I'm fully answering your question.
No, dude, yet. You are definitely. Because we've got the Olympics coming up, is there, you know, do you see esports in the Olympics?
Well, it kind of is.
Okay.
There was something that happened recently in Singapore. I wasn't involved enough with it to speak about it, like in a really educated way, but they're experimenting with a few different games.
Yep.
Some games, like it's something to get the ball rolling. And some of those games are like, Why are we doing this? It's not what we would consider esports to be. They're not playing Dota 2 and not playing all these other games. But Rocket League is this one game that's a very popular esport that's essentially cars with jetpacks on them playing soccer, like on the ground and mostly in the air. I don't know. It's like a combination of playing FIFA with cars, but it's also like snooker because you have to hit the ball in different angles. You know what I mean? To get it to go places.
Yeah.
Anyway, and that particular game is very difficult to disagree with because there's no guns, there's no violence, it resembles soccer, right? And so I think that is probably one of the first esports that'll be more widely accepted to people who have no idea what's going on. But yeah, the AIS even put together a little project. A friend of mine was running this one and is investigating like what's happening in the scene, because now that the Olympics are on the table, AIS is like, Australia likes to do good in the Olympics. So it's like, what are we going to do about it? Right. And it's forming. It's just, it's going to take a while because, you know, to make skateboarding and snowboarding Olympic sports, they were just like edgy and, you know, off the cuff sports. And it's like, oh, this is the type of person that does this. And like, that's what people like worried about, and now look at those sports, right? But the thing is that nobody would have necessarily said, oh, my kid's addicted to snowboarding, and they didn't have that uphill battle. And so there's a lot of education that needs to happen on where the benefits are and then how to manage the downsides and what to look for to make sure that we are playing in a healthy way and understanding that we need to fill those buckets in real life as well. You know what I mean? So it's definitely much more complex than traditional sports to get there. But the Olympics, being something as a as something to shoot for is going to change things, I would say, for a lot of people.
Yeah, there's a lot of layers to it, isn't there? It's
so many layers.
It's cool, but like, and what you were saying, how, you know, the soft skill development that you gain through a lot of video games, like communication, teamwork, critical thinking, problem solving, like it's a really interesting frame, and I hadn't heard it the way in which you shared just moments ago, is like what you would traditionally get from team sports, it's now, you know, is exactly what you can get through video games and through certain types of games, certain types of settings of video games. And perhaps also it's like a generational understanding of that from a parent perspective too, because it's like back in my day, we used to go kick the footy outside, and then it's 100%. Like, cool, but now in our day, what we do is we hang out online and we, you know, have our own in-jokes and we talk to each other over the internet. And it'd be cool to run some sort of case study around which vehicle produces, you know, more defined skills. Because I think it would be interesting, and that I reckon video games might just take the win. I'm not sure.
I've been part of both cultures. It's difficult to do the esports part properly. So let's be clear. Like, I don't think it's the greatest definition of esports, but Fortnite is considered an esport, right? Because there's competitions and it's a different format from like your fixture, your best of three. It's the whole thing for Battle Royale. So aside from my personal opinions on Battle Royale, Fortnite's an esport. You can play Fortnite in a very like toxic way, even with your friends, yelling at them, swearing, terrible sportsmanship. Like, you can do all those things. When it's unstructured, it gets worse and worse. So if you're just playing online with your friends after school, and if you're just playing, let's say, ranked or an online tournament with your friends, like sometimes the game itself structures its own little internal tournaments, that experience is completely up to you. It's not structured very well. If you're playing and you're representing your school, you can bet that if you're not like on top of your homework, someone else will sub it in for you. You know, like the teachers control the narrative a lot more. And if you're behaving in a toxic way, see you later. Or the admins in a sport in the league. So when I was the commissioner for Meta High School Esports, there were teams that we had to say goodbye to for a couple of terms because of the way they behaved. Mm-hmm. And the teachers are like, yep, thank you. I'm all over this, you know? And so there's the structure and the importance of it. Kids need to think that they're doing something important. You know what I mean? And especially if you got sponsors and a Twitch stream and stuff, kids are like, I'm going to be on stream. Like most kids, even athletes, they'd have to make it to a national level, maybe an international level, to ever get on TV. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
Yep. Yep.
And so this is high school kids getting on stream with casters going super excited about their plays and stuff. And then they get to record that and keep it. You kidding me? Mm. Like there's a lot of it, when the structure is there, it's like this. Instead of sport can be toxic too. Don't get me wrong, right? Yeah. People should not forget that. And there's physical injuries. There's all sorts of things that are serious. But like sport maybe has this range where the bottom end is not nearly as bad as the bottom end of the value of gaming if somebody gets toxic and obsessive, right? And the high end is much more difficult to reach, but sport goes way up, right? And but esports, when it's got this bigger range, but it also can go way up. It's just very difficult to be, just bump my mic. It's very difficult to be in that upper echelon there without really good structure. And that's what's developing in the grassroots space now. The professional space still needs a lot of help as well, but for sustainability, I'd say. But like some of the leagues are just putting on a great show, you know, and it is really about the fans.
Mm, that's cool, man. That's cool. Mm. Mate, I really appreciate your time and your insights on these things. I found it very, very interesting. A question that we ask all of our guests here on the podcast, to pay respect to my beloved co-founder of the Potty and Arrive and Thrive, Dan Lenardi, who is no longer with us, is, you know, this question: what are you roaring about? So cue his intro music.
Taco. I'm roaring.
What are you roaring about at this point? Can be anything at all. Books, could be video games.
Okay. All right. What am I roaring about? So it's been a bit of a ride from the coaching perspective with my two teams. One of them's just is in playoffs right now. The other team is, this is Team Bliss for the LCO. This is League of Legends. They're in playoffs right now, so they can get a spot in the final so they can go and compete overseas. That's what we're trying to do. And then we just finished Six Invitational for the Rainbow Six team, and that's where they finished in top eight. There's been a lot of exciting coaching moments and, you know, big pressure situations and player moments. And yeah, me trying to help a little bit, but really my job is to find ways to no longer be needed. You know, they've got to be able to become their own, in this case, their own men. But what I'm roaring about is how often I can come back to a particular book about mental performance that I love, which is called The Inner Game of Tennis by Timothy Galloway. There's a lot of good books I'm reading. I could mention a lot more, but let's just focus on that one. Inner Game of Tennis is just, it defines competition for me, which I really love. And it talks about self one and self two. So I'll get just to three things. The meaning of competition, essentially, if I'm paraphrasing, the meaning of competition, according to this book, is that you would not be able to grow without an opponent. Right. So you need that other person to test your mettle and see how good you can get, see your own progression, see those things. So your opponent is really your friend. Like your opponent is someone. And I think martial arts gets this right, where you bow to your opponent, you show them respect. It's like you're bowing, you're saying, thank you for this opportunity, because without you, none of this is possible. Mm. You know? And so it's about testing your mettle. It's not about winning and losing. It's about performing. And I love that because that's how I sort of coach. And then the other two things are really, really awesome. And I think everybody can relate to in one degree or another, but they talk about self one and self two. And self one is your sort of analytical mind. It's that inner dialogue that might make you miss the second serve in a tennis game and double fault because you're like, oh, I missed the first one. I might miss the second. Like it's all that inner dialogue and self-judgment and all those things that get in the way of performance. And self two is kind of related to a flow state or the zone. It's related to that. Self two is when you trust yourself to do the thing that you trained and you don't interfere with your mind. And so getting into the zone is the ultimate peak experience for any athlete or creative artist or anybody, right? And so I love the idea of reverse engineering the zone for my players as much as I can. It's like you're never going to be able to access it on purpose, but you can increase the chances of this accident, you know? And self two and understanding self two and how, you know, you have to bring humility, for example, to be able to get into self two is something that is really at odds with a lot of esports professionals who have egos. And then it's like this progression from player to athlete to warrior, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. And I'm trying to build warriors with these guys. And that book is kind of like, if I think they have the attention span, it's required reading, basically.
Love that. That's on my Kindle list, actually. Once I finish current one, I've got to jump into that because I've heard a few people recommend it. Mate, how can people get in contact with you and explore your material at Game Aware? I was fortunate enough to see some of your online courses and they're fantastic. So how can people get in contact and explore your material?
Oh, thanks. Look, it's gameaware.com.au. And if you're coming from a school, just slash school, we've got free consultations, whether you're a family looking for a bit of support or a clinician looking for training. If you're a school looking for presentations or embedding our online courses into short courses, into units or into pastoral care or a gaming club, and the parent course for the parents, like we have a very holistic approach, and we'll help you set up your gaming club as well if you like. All that kind of stuff. There's previews for all that stuff on the school's page as well. But yeah, just reach out and we'll have a chat and see if we can help you guys out.
Awesome. Thanks, mate. Really appreciate your time coming on the show.
No worries. Thanks for having me.